This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In recent years, New Hampshire and many other states have enacted new rules and regs around voting. In 2012, the Granite State, for the first time, required people show ID at the polls. And this year, the legislature passed a bill requiring folks live in the state for 30 days before they'd be allowed to cast a ballot. Governor Hassan vetoed that measure a few weeks ago after a familiar debate around this proposal and others like it. Supporters of these measures say they're needed to protect our elections from fraud, while opponents fear they could deny someone a fundamental right, the right to vote. Now these laws are getting new scrutiny, given a federal appeals court decision last week that rejected a Texas voter ID law. The panel called the law a breach of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which was, by the way, signed 50 years ago. Today in The Exchange, reviewing voter laws, both here and nationwide. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Before we get into the current debates, though, we're going to begin with some of that voting rights history. With us for more on that is Professor Guy Charles. He's founding director of the Duke University Center on Law, Race, and Politics, and a professor of law at Duke. He's an expert on constitutional law, election law, politics, and race. And Guy Charles, great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, lots of attention to this 50th anniversary a week ago. Just remind us, Professor Charles, what exactly did the Voting Rights Act say?
Well, so what you have to think about is that the Voting Rights Act was enacted as a way of responding to the fact that the 14th Amendment, which provides for the prohibition of racial discrimination, the 15th Amendment, which provides for the elimination of racial discrimination in voting. So the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the prohibition on racial discrimination in voting in the 15th Amendment were essentially unenforced following the Reconstruction period. So around, say, 1876, 77 or so. And so for the latter 20 or so years of the 19th century, a lot of states, specifically in the South, engage in rampant discrimination against voters of color, specifically African-American voters and African-American citizens. And so from, say, the late 19th century till about the middle of the 20th century, when the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, black voters, especially in the South, really did not have a right to vote or weren't protected by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So the purpose of the Voting Rights Act was to respond to the rampant racial discrimination that was going on, particularly in the South.
How did that racial discrimination look? How was it carried out? It wasn't a blanket, you know, if you're African-American, you can't vote, but there were other ways.
That's right. So there were many devices that were used in order to disenfranchise black voters. So one of the things that the easy one was violence. So for people who were showing up at the polls, the Ku Klux Klan was founded right around that time. People would show up. They would lynch people. They would engage in violence in order to discourage people from showing up at the polls. And then there were other devices that were used. So, for example, poll taxes were included when many states in the South held constitutional conventions and implemented a poll tax. It's saying that if you're going to go to the polls, if you want to vote, then you have to pay a certain amount. And they sometimes included what was called a grandfather clause, meaning that, well, if your grandfather fought in the Civil War or if your grandfather had the right to vote at a particular time, then you didn't have to pay the poll tax. And in some jurisdictions, the poll tax was cumulative. So if you missed it 1 year, if you couldn't pay it 1 year, then it added on and added on. And of course, many African-American voters did not have the means to pay the poll tax. But even those who had the means to pay the poll tax, there were other types of devices that were used. So literacy tests was another one that was used. And even for those who could read, poll worker, if you made any type of a mistake or if they didn't understand what you were saying, they would deny you the right to register so that you can vote. So there were many devices that were used. Racial gerrymandering was another one that was used in order to assure that African Americans were removed from particular districts or packed into certain types of districts. So many devices were used in order to deny folks the right to vote. And you're right, it wasn't a blanket statement, if you're black, you can't vote. It is trying to identify what are the types of characteristics that are likely to be the ones that African Americans might bear. So, for example, we know that there was a huge difference in the literacy rates between whites and blacks in the South in the late 19th and early 20th century because of the problem of schooling for African Americans. And so that's why the literacy device was one of the things that were used.
So it sounds like some of these devices were at the point of registration, Professor Charles, and others were at the actual point of voting.
That's right. Some were at the point of registration, some were at the point of voting, some were completely outside of the polling place. So if people found out that you were interested in registering or you tried to register, they might show up at your house. So there are many differences throughout the process. And of course, we're also thinking about a Jim Crow period of segregation where it wasn't just voting discrimination that was going on, but broad society-wide discrimination, of which voting discrimination was a central part.
You know what I'm struck by just hearing you review some of this history, Professor Charles? You're talking about a long period. I mean, post-Civil War, basically, you know, mm-hmm. give or take some couple of years, all the way up through the 1960s. That's a long time.
That's right. We are talking about a very long period, and I think that's one of the things that people may not appreciate, that the length of officially state-sponsored discrimination, especially in voting, but not just in voting, was a very long time. And for a very brief period, I mean, what's interesting about the history, for a very brief period during the Reconstruction period, African Americans did vote, participated, and in fact were senators in the United States Congress, members of the House of Representatives, and in their state legislatures. So for a very brief period, we had great political participation by African Americans, particularly in the South. But for a large period of the modern history, what we see today is actually an exception in terms of, you know, today all of us are used to seeing people showing up at the polls and no rampant discrimination, at least explicitly, on the basis of race. But for a long part of our history, it was the opposite. Racial discrimination was the norm, again, from the late 19th century period on.
Wow. So here we have this history all the way up to the early 60s, 1965, the Voting Rights Act passes. Just bring us back to Professor Charles, maybe like 1960, 61, and tell us about some of the people and events that started to push this legislation forward.
Well, so one of the things that we know from the history is the way that African Americans, particularly not just in the South, but also nationwide, resisted discrimination in housing and transportation, et cetera. And of course, the rise of the Civil Rights Movement and the March on Selma, which the movie came out, and I think this is in the minds of a lot of people currently, the March on Selma was a strong impetus for the passage of the Voting Rights Act. In many ways, the civil rights movement culminated in some respects in something like the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It was extremely important and a major goal. The Voting Rights Act was a major goal of the civil rights movement, and they were responding to the problems of discrimination. So just to provide a very quick example, if you take the state of Alabama, over in 1947, less than 2% of the African Americans in Alabama were registered to vote. In 1964, it was somewhere around 20% of African Americans who were registered to vote. Now, with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, almost immediately the registration rates rose in Alabama from, say, about 20%, 23% in 1964 to about 55, 56% in 1968. So you could see the impact of the Voting Rights Act, and it was responding to a history, and that history manifested itself in the numbers that we see in terms of registration rates and participation rates. And what African Americans did, and not just African Americans, but white allies, formed the civil rights movement as a result of the racial discrimination, and culminating in things like the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
We're talking with Professor Guy Charles, founding director of the Duke University Center on Law, Race, and Politics, and a professor of law there. We're looking briefly at the history of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which observed its 50th anniversary last week. In a few minutes, we'll turn to some contemporary debates on voting rules and regulations, including a new Texas federal appeals court case on a Texas voter ID law. But for the next few minutes, we're just reviewing some of the history that plays a role in this discussion. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. So, Professor Charles, great history, and you talked about the huge jump in African-American voter registration from before the Voting Rights Act to now. How do you see recent developments around voter ID laws in the context of this voting rights legacy that you've painted for us?
So you could think of the Voting Rights Act as doing basically three things. One of the things that it did is that it said we can't trust the southern states, not just the southern states, but primarily the southern states, because of their relentless attempt to try to deprive African Americans of the right to vote. So one of the things that they did is they sent the Voting Rights Act sent federal examiners and observers to assure that when African Americans showed up at the polls, they were going to be able to vote. The Voting Rights Act also, and this is one of the most controversial provisions of the Act, sections 4 and 5 of the Act said, look, if you are a state that had a history of racial discrimination and it identified certain characteristics of those states, though it didn't name them by name, it said before you pass anything related to voting, you have to pre-clear that with the Justice Department or the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. And so what you saw was a long term for the next 40 or so years, an attempt to prevent those discriminatory
acts. Professor Charles, I got to wrap you up, but we will pick up this thought after a short break. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the state of voter rules and regulations on the Voting Rights Act's 50th anniversary. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. In a few minutes, we'll turn to current debates about new voting laws around the country. But we're finishing up a look at the history of the Voting Rights Act with Professor Guy Charles at Duke University. And Professor Charles, just before the break, you were giving us your thoughts on how this history that you've outlined informs or shapes current debate. And I want to let you finish up there. Go ahead.
Sure. So the real question is whether the structure that was put in place in order to prevent new voting restrictions from going into place is still necessary. And whether the things that we are seeing today are new versions of racial discrimination, because part of the history is that every single time we tried to limit racial discrimination, the states would come up with new devices, especially the ones that were covered by Sections 4 and 5 of the Act, with new devices in order to engage in racial discrimination. So is it still necessary to have barriers to prevent racial discrimination, and are the new devices that we're seeing today related to legitimate state action, such as worrying about voter fraud, or are they devices to discriminate people on the basis of race? And in short, my view is that it's very complicated. I think it is related to race, but it's not just about race. There are other things that are going on, though race is an important part of the explanation.
All right. Well, questions that we'll explore for the rest of the hour. Professor Charles, thank you very much for giving us your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Guy Charles, founding director of the Duke University Center on Law, Race, and Politics. And we turn now to some of these contemporary debates that Professor Charles alluded to. You can join us with your comments, questions about various voter requirements that we're seeing in New Hampshire and elsewhere around the country. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. For the rest of the hour, we're joined by Tomas Lopez, counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, which is a law and public policy institute. Tomas is counsel for the center's democracy program, where his work focuses on voting rights and elections. And Tomas Lopez, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Ilya Shapiro, senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. And Ilya Shapiro, thank you also for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, and Ilya, I'll turn to you first. We just heard a brief history of the Voting Rights Act. How do you see that history playing into our current debates over voter requirements?
Well, as Chief Justice Roberts wrote in the Shelby County opinion 2 years ago, the world has changed since 1965, thankfully. We don't have the ingenious devices and blatant systemic racial disenfranchisement, and that's a very good thing. And that means we can revert to the norm of having states administer elections and have lawsuits against those states in those instances when there are violations. I think the Voting Rights Act has been a grand success and should continue to be so, using Sections 2 and 3, Section 2 that goes after specific instances of racial discrimination, and Section 3 that says if a particular jurisdiction has so many of these violations that they need to be put under court supervision, then in effect the court supervises them like the Department of Justice would have generally all of the covered states before Shelby County. I think that's a very good system going forward, and we'll see what happens. Under Eric Holder's attorney generalship, there have been very few Section 2 suits filed, I think that's probably a good thing. It's a sign that the level of racial discrimination in voting, while not eradicated, has gone down.
So just to make sure I get you right, Ilya, the world has changed since 1965, and we don't need quite the level of federal oversight that perhaps we once did. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's the obvious point, but we can't even have it constitutionally, because to justify the diversion from the normal federal operation, that is, that states get to administer their election just like they administer their criminal laws, their tort laws, and other things that are properly up to the states, unless there's such systemic violation, extraordinary circumstances, as the Supreme Court put it in the 1966 case that approved Section 5, unless there are those sorts of things, and the federal government can't preemptively come in and effectively put those states under electoral receivership.
All right. And your view, Tomas, that the world has changed in 50 years, and as Ilya says, thank goodness, in terms of voter discrimination. What do you think?
I think we would agree that we're not quite where we were in 1965, thankfully, that we've come a long way. But I think the past 2 years have shown that there's still a need for a Voting Rights Act with the protections that we used to have under Section 5. The Voting Rights Act was put in place to stop racial discrimination in voting, and we saw just last week that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals largely upheld a decision from a federal court in Texas that found a voter ID requirement in Texas to be discriminatory, to actually keep because of that requirement, over 600,000 registered voters unable to vote.
Well, and Tomas and Ilya, Tomas, you first. Both of you have mentioned Section 5, Section 2, Section 3. For those who aren't intimately familiar with the Voting Rights Act, Tomas, just tell us what you're referring to there.
Sure. So the Voting Rights Act has a number of provisions in there, and Section 5 in particular is the section that provided that there are a set of jurisdictions. So those could be states. Those could also sometimes end up being counties, sub-state divisions, that because of a history of racial discrimination in voting had to have their election law changes, what they call pre-cleared, by the federal government or by a court. And so there was a whole set of states and parts of states that were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. There was a set of states that were initially covered when the law was passed, and then that expanded at points in history. Over the 50 years that we've had the Voting Rights Act, Congress, most recently in 2006, would reauthorize the law. They would reauthorize the formula that was in place that was actually in a separate part of the law. And we talk about the Shelby County decision, and that's a decision from 2013 in which the United States Supreme Court invalidated the formula that was used to determine what states were covered by Section 5.
And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Ilya, some counties in New Hampshire were part of that, correct? There's mostly southern states, but I think New Hampshire was involved in that 2013 decision.
That's right. It was a seemingly a random assortment of states, something like 6 of the 11 states of the old Confederacy, parts of states all across the country, Arizona, South Dakota, New Hampshire included 3 of the 5 boroughs in New York. I don't know what's different between Manhattan and Queens, but that's the way that the formula ran, and that's part of the reason why the Supreme Court struck it down. It was based on voter registration and voting rates or disparities between blacks and whites in the 64, 68, and 72 elections. So we're talking more than 40 years ago, and Congress never updated the formula to match whatever propensity for violating voting rights might exist in current times.
All right. Well, both of you, let's go to our listeners, and then I have a lot more questions for you about some of the specifics that we've seen in states around the country, including that Texas case that we keep alluding to. But let's go to our listeners. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. And Renee joins us from Contoocook. Hi, Renee. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I believe that the vote is the basis of every other right in our United States, and that every American citizen, every adult American citizen has that right. And it's like nothing else. Not like getting a driver's license or anything else. It's basic. And so when the requirement for the ID came in, I refused to show it. And I vote every time, and I always refuse to show it because I don't think anybody has the right to stand there and ask me for anything else between me and the ballot.
So what happens to you, Renee, when you go to the polls in Contoocook and you don't show an ID?
They call the town clerk over, and he has to sign that he knows me. I mean, the people sitting there, they know me. I've been voting there for 25 years. But he comes over and says he knows me. I get a letter from the Justice Department later that comes in, and I have to sign that was my vote. Now they say they might take my picture, which I consider intimidation. But I'm going to keep doing it until the Supreme Court lays down the law, and then I'll respect the Supreme Court. But when I worked in community mental health in Concord, we encouraged our clients to get to know the issues, especially around mental health services, and you know there are many, and to vote. We let them know they have the right to vote, which some of them didn't even realize.
So, Renee, here's a question for you, and I'm not picking on you. I'm just trying to present another side here, and I'd love your thoughts because this is really interesting. So you go to Contoocook. You don't show an ID. You're able to vote because they say they know you. Do you have anything preventing you from going to Concord or Hopkinton or Bow and sort of demanding the same right?
If I was going?
Yeah. What's to prevent you from doing that in another town?
Well, I'm a registered voter.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I have the right to vote, just as I did for the last 25 years. I'm just saying, don't ask me for anything additional. If you know that I have been fraudulent, present me with that evidence. Take me out of the poll.
So you've registered in good faith with all the right documents, and from there on out, you feel you should be good.
Right. I registered 50 years ago.
Okay. Renee, good to hear from you. This is really interesting. Thank you for calling. Ilya Shapiro, what do you think? She did it the right way at registration 50 years ago, and now she feels she should be good to go.
Well, let's be clear. Everyone who's a properly registered voter should be able to vote. The goal of a well-administered election is that everyone who is eligible to vote and who's registered is allowed to vote, and people who are not are not. And there are errors in both ways. And the question you raise, I think, gets to the heart of the matter. What if she goes outside of her district or her precinct and starts voting for people that in districts where she's not an eligible voter? What if she moves to a different state and just decides to show up? There's that system in place, as she said, that if someone signs an affidavit, the clerk signs an affidavit that they know who she is, and then that's verified by the state or federal officials, that's fine. That's kind of the back check on that. But the Supreme Court has said already in a case out of Indiana, the Crawford case in 2006, I believe, that voter ID, if administered properly and not putting a great burden on someone to get that ID, does not per se violate the Constitution. And so, I'm not a huge fan of voter ID. You know, there's not that much impersonation fraud. What fraud there is tends to be through absentee ballots and other measures. But generally, the American people, by overwhelming majority's favor, they feel that enhances confidence in elections, and that includes, at least according to a 2012 Washington Post poll, two-thirds of blacks and Hispanics. So, I think both sides, really, in the voter ID debate specifically, overblow things. There's not that much impersonation fraud. There's not that much people getting prevented from disenfranchisement based on not having ID. And the Texas voter ID case that Tomas mentioned, that was kind of about a statistical sampling of what kind of populations tend not to have ID. And that's true, that the poorer you are, and the poor tend to be disproportionately racial minorities, there's a lesser rate of having that voter ID. But there are things that different states other than Texas have done to improve that, to improve those types of services. That's a separate discussion.
Well, and Tomas, to you, to Renee's call and Ilya's point, why not have just that extra check? Most people, as Ilya says, seem okay with that.
Well, I think what's worth noting is that, states do have the ability, states are required to make sure that people are who they say they are. You know, I think where we start seeing problems is where we have these strict photo ID laws in place that do, as we see in Texas and in some other places, keep people from the polls. But there are other ways in which you can actually make sure that people are on the voter rolls, that they are properly registered. I think we'd all agree we want people to have confidence in elections, that elections should be secure. But we can do that without actually discriminating against folks.
You know, it's interesting that you say, Ilya, that you don't really see that much voter fraud, and that's what voter ID laws are aimed at. And a bunch of states have these laws, I think more than half. So if that's the case, Ilya, that there aren't that many actual cases of, me showing up and saying I'm Susie Smith instead of Laura Kanoi, why do we have so many of these laws, Ilya?
Well, it's the same reason we have any sorts of laws to administer elections in an orderly way and enhance the confidence that people have that their elections are going along smoothly. You know, they do happen, the instances of fraud, or sometimes just inadvertent people voting in the wrong place, or they've moved and they think they're still eligible in their old place, or didn't realize that the registration didn't transfer. And these things are, it's not necessarily that there's systemic, schemes of voter impersonation going on. But I think it does help the orderly administration of elections, just like, the way that, it's part of election administration. I don't think it's an attempt to suppress votes or to somehow prevent people from voting who should be voting, as I said. And in the majority of states where courts have approved voter ID laws, Texas is a minority case that it's been at least temporarily put on hold. Ultimately, I think there will be a voter ID in Texas. The court has now been sent down to reshape what exactly that law is going to be. But in states like South Carolina, Georgia, Indiana, there's lots of states where as long as they make it easy and cheaper, free to get the ID, that's not courts are okay with that. And the Constitution says if the state wants to do it, they can. And as you said, a majority of states do.
All right. Let's take another call. And thank you again for that one, Renee. The number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, in light of the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, we're looking at some contemporary debates around voting rules and regulations. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And to Hebron, Robert's on the air. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Yeah, good morning. I think I have a simple solution to discrimination and also to the fact that a lot of people have trouble getting to the polls because of work schedules. Everybody has a Social Security number in the United States, and most everybody now has either a cell phone or a computer. Why can't we have a voting system that's linked with our Social Security number and vote online? That would eliminate discrimination. And it would also eliminate the problem of people not being able to get to the polls because of work.
Or weather and all that other stuff. Robert, thank you very much for the question. Tomas, do any states allow people to vote online?
Well, you know, I think that's a great question, and it's one that we hear a lot. You know, I think as far as online voting goes, I think this is something that maybe we're not quite ready for. I think there are differences in among folks who work with this stuff, who whether or not Internet voting is something that's viable right now. I think there are a lot of really valid questions about whether it would be secure, especially given recent news about hacking and security of government databases. But at the same time, I think the caller raises a really good point, and that's that in much of the country, our voter registration system is antiquated. There are things that states can do to extend voting access to people that are relatively easy, that can actually save money, that can increase security. And I'm talking about moving to electronic forms of voter registration, registering to vote online, having database sharing between state agencies. Just this year, Oregon passed a law that's providing that when you go get a driver's license in that state, you are automatically registered to vote.
Motor voter laws, right, Tomas? That's what they're
called. Motor voter laws, but this, you know, in Oregon, they're calling it new motor voter.
All right.
In other words, and so what this is it's not just where they say, excuse me, ma'am, would you like to register to vote? You are put on the roll, and then you have the ability to opt out.
Automatically. I'm going to cut you off there, Tomas, but we'll pick it up after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're discussing voter rules and regulations in light of the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and a federal appeals court ruling recently rejecting a Texas voter ID law. We're looking at how and why most states have tightened up their voting requirements recently, including New Hampshire. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Ilya Shapiro is with us, senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Also with us, Tomas Lopez, counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, which is a law and public policy institute. Tomas runs the center's democracy program, focusing on voting rights and elections. And Tomas, go ahead real quickly. You were finishing up your point in response to our caller who wanted to know why we can't vote online. And you were talking about what they do in Oregon, where you're automatically registered to vote when you get a driver's license with the choice of opting out if you don't want to vote.
Exactly. And so when we see laws like the ones in Oregon, which just passed this year, which we're only just beginning to see implemented, we think it's really exciting. There are common sense reforms that lawmakers can put in place that's going to make voting more accessible to people, things like what we call portability. This is the ability for if you move from one part of your state to another part of your state, your voter registration moves with you instead of having to re-register. I think the voter registration process can be really opaque. Voting can be very opaque, and what we need to do is make the process much more accessible, not just to people in general, but in terms of how they use it.
Well, here's a couple emails that have come in, gentlemen. And here's one from Nick in Hampstead. He says, is this a solution in search of a problem, meaning voter ID? Nick says, it seems that any fraud associated with voting would be well within the margin of error of the vote counting mechanisms. Would we not be much better off putting our efforts into reducing that error? So there's Nick in Hampstead. Thank you, Nick. And here's one from Rob. He says, maybe they know Renee in her town. This is Renee, our earlier caller, who refuses to show ID in Contoocook. But Rob says, I feel it is my right as a U.S. citizen to make sure that everyone who votes in her town is a U.S. citizen. Rob says voter ID is a good thing. You have the right to vote if you are a registered U.S. citizen. And I feel I should have the right to know you are who you say you are and that you're only voting once. Rob says even one instance of fraud is too many. Thank you for those emails, gentlemen. And Tomas, I want to throw Rob's point to you. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, in response to what Rob raises, I think what we would say is that, again, we can make sure that people are who they say they are, but that we need to do this in a way that actually makes sure that people still have access to the vote. I go back to Texas, where that sampling found that around 4.5% of registered voters in that state lack the sort of ID that's necessary there. And so this is a place where you can't use your University of Texas ID to vote, but you can use a concealed handgun permit. You know, we think we need to have voting systems that are fair.
You talk about university IDs, and here's another email from Kathleen. She says, I have been a voter since I came of age to vote. When I lived away at college, I voted absentee in my hometown elections. When I was a student in Germany, I also voted absentee in my hometown elections. Kathleen says, I am concerned about college students voting in New Hampshire. I believe college students should vote in their hometowns. As we all know, the vast majority of New Hampshire college students do not stay after graduation. Kathleen asks, what is to keep the students at UNH, for example, from running the town of Durham in addition to voting for presidents? And I'll turn to both of you on this, but you first, Ilya. This has been a big ongoing debate here in New Hampshire. Go ahead. College students, where they should be allowed to vote.
Well, different states do it different ways. I believe that most give college students a choice. Do they want to keep voting at home, meaning not re-register in wherever their college town is, or do they want to register where they're going to school? I'm agnostic on that choice as a matter of policy. I suppose college students have more transient interest generally, and so probably it's better for them to be voting in their hometowns. You know, it might not be as familiar, or they certainly don't have as much stake necessarily in the issues of their new state or their new city. But I think there should be definitely better cooperation, as Tomas was alluding, better technological implementation of the electronic registration. So if the student does register in their new place, then their old registration is the clerk is notified, or the rolls are adjusted.
Absentee, Ilya, does take some planning, right, and some forethought, something that a lot of us don't do, perhaps even more so college students.
Well, sure, but that's kind of that's the nature of life. If you feel that you want to vote, it's at the end of the day, college students have better than anyone. They're on their phones, they're on the computer. You know, they can, you know, Google how do I vote in whatever state it is, and figure out how to do the absentee ballot. You know, at the end of the day, we want voting to be simple and straightforward, but not the absolute most convenient way. You know, sitting in your pajamas at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's very convenient doing it online. But I agree with Tomas, the technology simply isn't there for that. And so, you know, there has to be a balance between convenience, absolute convenience, and maintaining the integrity of the system.
Well, and it's interesting to hear you say, Ilya, that different states do it differently in terms of how they view college students. What do you see, Tomas, and what do you think is ideal?
Well, I think, you know, students have a right to register and vote in the place that they consider home. And so if that is where they left to go to college, they should be able to vote while they're there. And if that's, in fact, the place where they came from, they should be voting absentee. I think it's relatively straightforward in that way. I mean, these students who are living in a place, they are living in that place. And if they consider that place home, it makes sense for them to participate in the elections there.
So they should be allowed to make that decision, not the jurisdiction itself? It doesn't have a say?
Well, jurisdictions obviously have a right to, you know, set their eligibility. You know, But at the same time, if you live in a place and you consider it your home, that's a part of what being in a democracy is. And I think that keeping students from voting as a class, you know, saying that you need to find some way to put down those roots and go back to where you came from, I think is something that shuts these individuals out of the system who are fully eligible voters.
Well, again, thank you for that email, Kathleen. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's a tweet from Theo who says the GOP tries to prevent young people in New Hampshire from voting because they don't like how we vote. Bill O'Brien, that's our former Republican House Speaker, for our guests who aren't from New Hampshire, Bill O'Brien admitted as much. Theo, thanks for the tweet. So that's kind of the elephant in the room, Ilya, or the political elephant. Opponents of these tighter rules and regulations around voting feel it's all one big Republican plot to keep Democratic-leaning voters away from the polls. I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, it turns out that different types of rules of election administration work differently in different states based on the urban-rural split, based on what kind of employers are there. For example, in early voting, the states that have it, not all states do, and there's no correlation between whether it's a Republican state or a Democrat state or a purple state about rules like that. In some states, studies have found that early voters tend to be more Democratic. In other states, they tend to be more Republican. So it really depends. Again, you know, states have a lot of freedom under the Constitution to choose their election administration rules. In every state, whoever has the majority in the legislature is going to try to craft rules to their advantage, especially if this comes up in districting rather than some of these other rules and regulations. And the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that gerrymandering based on political considerations is okay. Where it gets mixed in with race is when it starts being problematic. Perhaps the ultimate solution is just to draw districts as close to natural boundaries and, you know, cities and counties and things like that. The problem there is that runs afoul of some ways that the Voting Rights Act, the Section 2 that we were talking about, the one that's still in place, how it's been interpreted to prevent so-called voter dilution. That is, you would, if you districted along those kind of natural boundaries to produce more symmetrical, coherent districts, then you would have fewer majority-minority districts and, in theory, fewer racial minorities being elected.
You know, it's interesting, the history that we talked about earlier with Professor Guy Charles, Ilya, that so much of voting is still state-based, as you said. So you've got just vastly different rules in every state. Why is that? And is that a good way to go?
Well, I mean, let's be clear. It's not vastly different. I mean, you can say that some states allow no early voting. Other states might allow 4 weekends of early voting or 14 days or something like that. Is that called vast? I don't know. But those are the kind of differences we're talking about. It's not that, you have to perform physical gymnastics in one state to qualify in another state. You have to do mental gymnastics and all these other things. There's a great deal of federalism in our system more broadly, as I mentioned at the outset. Criminal laws, tort laws, family law, all of these things differ from state to state. And election administration, again, as long as you're complying with the 14th and 15th Amendment, equality under the law, and you're not racial disenfranchising people, states do have a lot of leeway. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't best practices and there aren't things that states should do to harmonize their registration rolls and things like that. So the President's Commission on Election Administration last year, the bipartisan commission with the counsel to both the Obama and Romney campaign headed it up, it came out with a lot of sensible proposals about increasing the confidence in the polling machines themselves, how to administer open polls for longer and busier places, these sorts of things. So there are all sorts of completely nonpartisan, not just bipartisan, but nonpartisan good government reforms that could be put in But at the end of the day, states do and can have their separate preferences.
What do you think, Tomas, about how state-based this is? I mean, and Ilya's right, you know, one state doesn't make you do a song and dance number while the other one doesn't. But there are some differences among states. Some have early voting, some don't. Some have motor voter registration, some don't. Some have voter ID laws, some don't. What do you think about that system, and is it a good one?
Well, I think the reality of our election system is that it is largely state-based, and I think that's a fact. And I think one of the things that we see as a result of that is that some states, in some ways, are a lot better than others at actually making voting as accessible as it should be. I think there are opportunities to, I can't speak right now about the ability for us to do what's possible to make greater reforms at the federal level. You know, I think there are obviously, there constitutionally the federal government has power over federal elections and can set certain rules, but we do have a system where states get to have a humongous say in how our elections are administered. We see great differences. You know, one example of the patchwork that we see is early voting. We think early voting should be a lot more available than it is in many places. And another example are our felony disenfranchisement laws. There are millions of people in the United States who have fully completed their incarceration but cannot vote because they live in places where they're banned from voting for life. New Hampshire is not one of those places. New Hampshire is a place where once you're out of prison, you're able to vote. But this is something that is not covered by the Voting Rights Act, according to the courts. It's something that we've had to work to change through our legislatures, through our political process, and there's a lot of work to be done, but I think it's one of the most stark examples we have about the differences in voting laws across the country.
Let's take one more call, gentlemen, and this is Wade in Hillsborough. Hi, Wade. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I live in Hillsborough, and in the 2012 election, I think it was, I used to drive the senior van, which went around and picked up people for shopping trips and doctor's appointments to make sure that people in elderly housing and people who were shut in could get out and do what they needed to do. And in that election cycle, the town decided to make an extra effort to make sure that any elderly person who wanted to get to the polls and vote could be picked up at the door, taken to the polls, and taken home. So on one of the regular weekly runs, about two weeks before the election, I said, I hope everybody's going to vote. 2 weeks from now on Tuesday. And then this hot discussion started, and one person saying, well, I don't have any IDs anymore. I don't have a driver's license. Well, about half of the people who rode the elderly van didn't have driver's licenses anymore.
Wow.
They're people in their 70s and 80s. They tended to be poorer. I was the only person on the van who had a passport. And I said, well, you can get an ID, or you can go into the polls and fill out an affidavit or something. And then this discussion started among the elderly people on the van that was full of misinformation about how to get a government ID. And the most common comment was, I'm sick of filling out forms. I don't want to have to travel to Concord to fill out one more blasted form.
It's just too much trouble.
It was too much trouble, they thought, and everybody was confused. And despite my saying, well, you can go and you can vote and you're going to know people at the polls anyway, out of about 16 people who rode the senior van with some regularity, only two people went to the polls.
All right. Well, Wade, thank you for that story. What do you think, Ilya?
Well, government can't force people to vote. You can't shove information down people's faces. I think the information should be provided. Some states, the caller mentioned a senior van, send out vans of voter registration and then collecting them and taking them to the polls as well. providing, you know, dropping off leaflets at senior centers and assisted living facilities about, you know, here's what you need. If you don't have this form, have your son or daughter or someone who knows you fill out an affidavit. If you don't have that form, you know, it doesn't matter if you can't locate your birth certificate from 1920. You don't need that. You here's other pieces of information. Here's what you can do. So you know, I encourage that. It's generally not hard to register to vote. And the caller was right that it's mostly people just don't know and they think it's more difficult than it is. And whether you're talking about the previous caller with the mental health facility as well, you know, this is just this is the way life works. You can't have a utopia where everyone knows everything. And I don't think anyone is trying to prevent these senior citizens from voting. And I think we can all do a good job in trying to educate them and inform them and make it easy for them to get the whatever documents they need to be able to vote.
All right. Well, Wade, thank you for that call. And Tomas Lopez, Ilya Shapiro, thank you also for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.